California's on fire again. California's on fire again. And the orange groves at night burn expensive and bright, 'cause California's on fire again. Well, embers and sparks filled the air. Yes, embers and sparks filled the air. As my sister's left hand touched the gold of the band, I swear I saw sparks in the air.
Welcome to Listener's Voices. This is Frances, and I'm joined by my co-host,
Fran.
And I'm sorry for the depressing beginning song, but the whole impetus for this week's prompt, which is fire, came from our recent witnessing of the fires in California. And having being from California myself, I'm very accustomed to this cycle, but not in the wintertime. So, this show, Listeners' Voices, was intended to hear the voices of our listeners, having people contribute and engage with the radio station in this way, in any way. And to that end, we put out prompts, and we solicit responses from people over the course of 2 weeks now. And once we gather these, we put them together into a show. So this week we have 4 submissions from people in this area specifically. Sometimes our listeners are further afield. But we've got some responses, and we've got some songs that have been requested and others that I've just put in there to go along with these. And so
let's tell folks how, if after experiencing this show, if it's a first one, how they can find out more about it and how they might make a submission.
The website, ktwh.org, houses past shows and current prompts. And they can go to the website and click on the Programs tab and then shuffle down to Listeners' Voices, where they will be able to see 3 months
right
worth
now,
of?
Actually, it's still 6 months. It did trim down from a year's from everything we've ever done to about 6 months, and sometime in the summer. But it will get further weeded out. Well, I shouldn't say that. Trimmed down.
We have to share this apparently with other people who have shows on the station.
Right. Yeah. So it'll get pared down to the last 3 months and stay at that rate as soon as I get around to doing it.
Which gives you more impetus to go and check things on a regular basis, so you can listen to the shows you've missed and consider the prompts that we've given out, because you can always respond to past prompts. And you can be on our mailing list, ktwhwriters@gmail.com. We send out the prompts every new show, and we send you reminders on that. So if you want to be on our mailing list, you can participate in the show in that way. Let us know at ktwhwriters@gmail.com. So we also have other ways you can participate in the radio station at all times. There's openings, volunteer positions, and things you can learn and things you can participate in. And this show happens to be one of them. So if you'd like to play along with us during the week, during the month, or during the show itself, let us know.
Right. We are looking for volunteer co-hosts. We can't both be available at all times. And so you don't necessarily have to learn anything about running the board, any of the technical stuff. It's just to sit in here and help share, help the host share the submissions of the week, and maybe have something to contribute here and there about it. That's the least demanding role as far as this job goes. And if you'd like to get more involved with the production of it, we would welcome that as well. And we're always looking for prompt ideas.
Thank you. So once again, this week's prompt is fire. And we have the 4 submissions that we're going to share with you. I'm going to start with Richmond, who has submitted a response to every single one of our prompts. How long have we been doing this? Over a year?
Actually, the year anniversary is like sometime in this week.
Oh, great.
It was the first week, or possibly as late as the 9th of February, but our first show. So, yeah, we're at our anniversary show. Maybe the next one we'll call the anniversary.
Fantastic idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start with an interview practice session that I did with Fran at a friend's house. And it will lay out some of the concepts of what it is we're talking about today. And here it is.
This will be interesting to hear.
Hear yourself.
I was part of it, but yeah, it was like a couple of weeks ago. I have no idea what I said.
Today is January 23rd of 2025. And this is Frances, and I'm talking to Fran.
Okay, what would you like to talk about?
Well, my upcoming show is about fire, and I've done some research on what different entities there are that are involved in fire, specifically wildfire around here. We've got the state of Minnesota. We've got the forestry department.
Which forestry department?
The DNR. Is there another one?
Well, yeah, there's the Federal Forest Service and County Forest Service. And so, well, there's the Federal Forest Service. They have a huge wildfire response contingent. And then there's the state, and they have their own. These are like summer employees, plus they would have one person that's their main full-time job for a district, or a region it would be called. There's regions and there's districts. Anyway, the county has its own forestry department, but it doesn't have any fire response personnel.
What role do they play then? In
fire?
Yeah.
Only maybe, really none, but the county GIS department sometimes contributes information when there's ongoing fire. Yeah.
Okay. So the response to a fire would be managed by one of these entities?
Depending on whose land it's on, yes.
Oh.
I think of the state first because they own most of the land south of Superior National Forest. And then if it's on private land, I don't know why, where it's written down or how I think I know this. But if a fire is on private land, the state responds to, I guess, because the Federal Forest Service doesn't take any responsibility for anything that's outside of Superior National Forest. And actually, right, that would be the case. Then if it's on private land, it's within the forest, because the forest is this huge boundary that's about hundreds, millions of acres. There's a mix of ownership within the forest. So if it was on private land within Superior National Forest, then the feds, a.k.a. the U.S. Forest Service, would take responsibility for it.
So Two Harbors has a forestry office for the DNR.
Yes.
And that's who I thought forestry was. But that's not the feds.
Right.
Or that's not the USFS.
Right.
And the USFS is managing federal forest land only?
Mm-hmm. And then they would respond to fires on private land within their boundary.
But they don't manage
the land other than if they have some specific private forestry management agreement or something. But for one summer, so I've been in two different roles with this. I was on the Brimson Fire Department for 14 years, and that got started because of the blowdown incident in 1999, and we expected wildfires soon in the years thereafter because so many dead down trees. And so at that time, they were providing training, basic smoke chaser training, to any civilians who wanted to do it, whether you were with the department or not, because they wanted a lot of people prepared. So there was a lot of extra training going on, and the Brimson Fire Department I don't know what training they had had before this in wildfire specifically. They're more structure fire conscious or trained originally.
Focused.
Yeah, focused. But when I decided I would take this civilian training in must have been the spring of 2000 then, there were several people from the Brimson Fire Department taking that training at the same time. So they had never had it. I don't know if others had, but including a couple friends of mine. And so that was fun to have them in the class. We met at the Pequon Lake Township Fire Hall for the meetings. And I think it was three or four Saturdays in a row. So meanwhile, then they were recruiting, they were lobbying me to join the department. And I'm not quite in their coverage area. I'm about a mile outside of it, but they took anybody they could get. So then the next few years, they were contracted by the feds to do standby, to be out there with their trucks,
yes,
and gear and with all their stuff. And so I got a lot of time with that. We only responded to a couple actual fires, but we helped wildfires. But we responded. We helped with some prescribed burns also, which one of which was pretty adventurous because the winds changed and that's how things get into trouble. We didn't have trouble, but it was unexpected and different than they had planned. Anyway, so that was a good experience with the feds, and they do that a lot, contracting the volunteer fire departments to help in those situations. And then because of that, and working when there would be a fire, we would work together with the DNR because the state DNR out of Two Harbors would respond, of course, too. And so I got to know Rob Fastlin, who was a full-time forester there. And in the summer, he especially focused on fire response, on wildland fire. So when they had an opening for an actual paid position, smoke chaser, in the spring, he suggested me for that. And I spent just maybe that one or 2 years, and that would have been about 2008 for sure. And then when their dispatcher out of the Two Harbors office decided he was going to quit right in the middle of, it was the fall season, which is shorter and less intense, but it was still the fire season. Usually the seasonal smoke chasers work from sometime in April through sometime in June, and then again sometime in September through October until there's snow cover. And so it was October. And
what happens during July and August?
There's not much fire danger, so they don't need to keep people on all the time. As soon as things are leafed out, it's the leaf out that makes relieves the fire pressure. It's in the spring when everything is, the snow melt is done, everything is dry, but nothing is leafed out yet. That's when the greatest danger. Then there's enough moisture in all of that green leafed out stuff to, but it has, actually my first year I worked into July, well into July, because it was very dry year. That was 2009. So that was working as dispatcher, because the dispatcher who'd worked for several years suddenly decided to quit. So Rob Fastlin, I think I've thanked him in the past, but as time goes on, I'm more and more appreciative of him recommending me. So he invited me to come and stand in for the rest of the couple weeks of the season as a dispatcher. And then I got that job for the next 5 years, which was supposed to be less than half time. But the first year went well into July. I worked more than 6 months, and usually it was less than 6 months, but that first year was a lot. And I can't remember if there were other years more than that.
Did you enjoy that work?
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah. We don't have serious fires around here very much at all. We did have one was called the Full Moon Fire in October. I can remember where it is. And then we just monitored the Pagami Fire, probably 2010 or 11, started in the Boundary Waters, and it increased. It traveled so fast. And I've been thinking about this in relation to their radio role, because we were getting calls. I was getting calls there trying to find out where it was and should they evacuate. And there's hardly anybody living out there, but there were some people. And it just raced much faster than we were used to having fires travel around here. And you could see it, shots of the continent, you could clearly see this plume of smoke coming out of the Pagami Fire and drifting. And then they identified smoke in Europe having come from our Pagami Fires thing to have. And I don't know how it's done now. And I don't know. So if we establish some credibility as a radio station, and then could be, like there's always a public information officer who is the only person that's really designated to speak to the public about anything. But we would establish a relationship with that position and be sure that we could get timely information.
So that brings us to the topic of the station as part of an emergency response.
Yes, and I first want to say that we certainly have already established our own credibility as a radio station. I just, at the end there, was saying, when we establish ourselves as a credible, we've done that, but we haven't had a strong emergency response role yet. At the very beginning, and that's actually one of the reasons that this particular license that we have for low power 100 watt stations, very localized, is for that purpose. And they have served that purpose, I'm sure, much in California in the last month. And then I remember down in Texas, not long after we got started, that I can't remember what the incident was down there, but there were, we heard stories of low power stations down there playing a critical role. So when we first started out, we did have a relationship with the sheriff's department and had some people willing to be coming on after hours at times when we're not otherwise broadcasting, if there was something that the public needed to hear about. Hmm. And we need to reestablish that connection and reestablish the roster of people who are willing to respond to conditions, to anything that could happen in this area. So we are just in the process of getting that reinvigorated, that role for the station, and certainly looking for people who are interested in being part, whether you have any other connection to the radio station or not. This role happens to appeal to you if you have any background or not in either radio or emergency response, especially if you live in town and walking distance to the corner of 7th Avenue and 7th Street, where our studio is. You know, in the case of a blizzard, actually, I'll just tell a short story of just before the station began, but we were already thinking about it and working on it for already a year and a half, I think. Our first public meeting, where we openly invited members of the public to come and hear about the radio station, happened to be on the night of the June 2012 flood. That I got 9 inches of rain at my place. They had 12 inches of rain in Duluth, and I was not able to get into town. I had been at actually a fire department meeting up in Brimson, and the road between my house and the fire department was more than likely washed out by the time, you know, it was after dark. We're at the meeting. I'm figuring I better head home. I'm not going to get home. So I left to take the long way around to get home. And then even coming at it from the south, I couldn't get through. There was just so much water across the road. So I decided, okay, I have to go into Two Harbors and stay with a friend in Two Harbors. And the first two ways I tried to do that, there was too much water over the road. And finally, I found one way to do it. And I was thinking the whole time, if we had this station on the air yet at that time, people could be calling in. I was calling into the sheriff's department every time I found a place that was too much water on the road, and they appreciated that. But we would also be able to share that information in real time here if we had someone in the studio taking those calls and sharing that information. That's the kind of thing that could happen that we want to be prepared to respond to.
Yeah, it requires planning and practice and resiliencies. So planning for contingencies when things happen, and to have lots of people involved so that if that one person who's in charge of saving the station from going off the air or turning it on when it needs to be done, if they can't get there, backups. So many, many, many hands make light work, and we could all be part of this.
Right. Yeah. So you can either get in touch with us through this program, whose email you should know by now, but ktwhwriters@gmail.com, or through the regular station email, thcomradio@gmail.com. So that was kind of the impetus. That whole role of fire is what got this whole episode started.
Yes.
And your personal connection to that area that is still burning, some of it, I assume. They're not all contained yet out there.
It's such a complex issue, because even if all the fires are put out, one could start again this afternoon. So the fact that they're still burning is a source of anxiety, but everything is temporary. And because everything is temporary, everything is precious. And one has to have a bit of distance emotionally from that which is going on, even if it's in your own backyard. And to that end, I'm going to shift from emergency response to listeners' voices responses. And once again, thank you, Richmond, for always being there with us. And here is his submission.
Hello, this is Richmond responding to the prompt fire. January 20th, 2025, 4 p.m., Two Harbors, Minnesota. Out on the break wall, the temperature was a minus 28 degrees Fahrenheit. That was with the wind chill. I've been drawn to extreme weather events ever since I can remember. This particular afternoon, except for the inky, mysterious wall of low-hanging clouds hovering over our Wisconsin neighbor across the big lake, there was a chilly sunshine here in Two Harbors. Sunshine, with frigid wind speeds gusting 30 miles per hour, along with sea smoke. Sea smoke, swirling, rising tendrils of fog over the surface of Gitchigami, as the waters below, warmer than the frigid temperatures above, evaporate in an ethereal, otherworldly occasion, bearing witness to the natural world. Other than for the thrill of immersion in such an occasion, I'm drawn to place myself, with some risk, into the frosty environment so that I may capture dramatic photo and video to use at some later date, perhaps in a music nature-themed production to use at some later date for the sake of posterity. Lest you think I'm being reckless, I've 7 comfortably fitting layers of clothing over my torso, 3 layers on the lower extremities, 2 pairs of smart wool socks, a pair of sturdy hiking boots with micro spikes ice grippers when needed, and several layers of headgear with face coverings. Note that any gaps in coverage, any skin exposed, will become painfully apparent once placed into the harsh extremes of sub-zero temperature and wind. Hands, and fingers are the weakest link, and cataloging the beauty of these frigid phenomena require that a mitten must be removed from the right hand. Then, with phone camera held firmly in my still-mittened left hand, my right-handed fingers will attempt to activate the camera to commence the intended procedure. It requires planning. There can be no wasted moments. What to focus on, which direction to pan, left or right, up or down. A choreography of efficient, purposeful movement that leaves the tender flesh of fingers exposed for the least amount of time. Turning my back to the prevailing wind, feet planted firmly, I unzip the outer layer of my jacket, pull out my phone camera, and hit the red dot button to commence recording. This all must be done in good haste, as otherwise the fingers will chill so quickly as to not have enough warmth to activate the camera. Once the camera is out, I carefully turn myself panning into the wind, moving slowly to create the most dramatic effect as the cold burns, branding itself into the delicate tissues exposed. Once the shot is complete, I am now turning, Godspeed, getting my back once again to the wind, moving with haste and great care to get the device back into the inner sanctum between the layers of cloth before dexterity and purposeful movement have surrendered. At this juncture, there is no point in tapping the red dot to shut the video function off, as there is no longer the required warmth in those vulnerable phalanges. I've learned through experience that the video function will either shut off by itself, or if not, once the fingers have thawed sufficiently, I will shut off the camera and then we will be ready to tap it once again, beginning another sequence of filming. There are hand warmers inside my mittens to help me maintain some equilibrium of tolerability. The repeated exposures, though, are cumulative, with each bearing of finger burning with a cold fire of increasing intensities. This outing was particularly painful, and I must admit, as I turned around from the furthest point on the break wall, it's a 0.6-mile round trip, I had some concerns that I may have overdone it. After a brisk walk back to the car and with the steady presentation of hand warmers inside the mittens, thankfully everything regained a comforting sensibility of warmth. Fire and ice, cold like fire, may also burn, or at least give the sensation of. After all this foolishness, I headed over to Paul Van Hoven Park and watched more sea fog rising up across the bow of the Edna G. It was dark now, and even within the city limits of Two Harbors, the stars, shining cold and bright, were crisp against the January night sky. Elemental, starlight, a cosmology of distant suns not our own, light years away. Our sun also a star, burning with unfathomable ferocity, seemingly burning for eternity. But this flame too will at some point in timeless time extinguish, as all things in the temporal worlds change form. Fire, combustion starts our automobiles, cooks our food, warms our shelters, provides light, and under the umbrella of comfort, offers memorable moments sitting around the campfire. And as with all things elemental to life on Earth, fire may cause mass destruction, such as we are witnessing in the recent California firestorm events. It is an ending to this piece for which I am not well enough informed to comment further, other than to experience a sadness for the loss of life, wildlife, and human, along with loss of habitat, for which I find no consolation.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you
fire.
Saved and earned, but all of it's gone to burn. Might you know you've really been so bad. Now's your time, burn you, might you fall apart, to fall behind. Oh no, oh no,
you're gonna burn.
Fire
to destroy all you've done.
Contrast of that with Richmond's beautiful background music.
It was by his request that we played Arthur Brown sing Fire from 1969. But yes, huge contrast. But
yeah.
It appropriately intense to the topic of fire. It can be small and smoldering or raging inferno.
Indeed. Right. So I do want to mention, we really appreciate Richmond's productions. He puts his response together with this bit of background music, and there's also a video that goes with this production, and it's not there yet, but it will be on our KTWH YouTube channel sometime this week. And if you go there, you can already see other productions of Richmond's, his hour-long productions. And when he does these videos to accompany his listeners' voices submissions, we'll also be posting those as they become available. And then from there, you can find out about Richmond's own channel that has lots of really good listening.
All of his work.
Mm-hmm. Listening and viewing the video. Nature videos are beautiful and all from around the region.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Thank you, Richmond.
Another regular responder and participant in our journey here on Listener's Voices is Becky Norlean. And here is her submission.
This is Becky in Two Harbors. The topic this week is fire. I'm going to tell two stories that have to do with wildfire. They both come from Wilderness Canoe Base, a camp at the end of the Gunflint Trail on Seagull Lake out of Grand Marais. In 1974, I was there as a volunteer when the Prairie Lake fire happened. It wasn't super close, but we were getting smoke smell and very red sunsets. As the fire was about out, the Forest Service was recruiting help for mop-up crews, and our director offered that anybody who wanted to could go spend at least one day, and that's exactly what I did, signed up for one day. I was teamed with another person. We were patrolling the edge of a burned area looking for spots that were still smoldering, and we did find a few. We could squirt it out with our backpack pumps, also known as pecans, and a slightly more colorful name. And we had a tool called a Pulaski, part axe and part hoe, to cut through roots or dig up whatever else might be burnable to create a little bit of a fire line to keep the smoldering area from reigniting. Very interesting. Also very exhausting. When I got back to camp and went to change clothes, I found that the fine particles of soot had gone right through the cloth, and my skin underneath was just completely covered with soot. That was something I wasn't expecting. The second story is from 2007, the Ham Lake Fire. That fire was in May, just as the camp was getting set up for the year. The fire jumped to the islands, and most of the buildings of the camp were burned. A couple of the big ones were saved because they had sprinklers on the roof, and a couple of others just because the fire burned itself out before it got to the very tip of the island. Later in the summer, two friends and I were staying at Trails End Campground, a National Forest Service campground not terribly far away. One day we kayaked over and gave the camp some volunteer time. I worked with a crew that was picking through the rubble of a cabin called Morningside on the east side of Fishhook Island. It had been the director's cabin and was sometimes used for gatherings. It was really interesting to find the pieces of twisted and fused glass. And we were picking out all the nails. I don't remember what else, but, you know, basically helping clean up the rubble. And just at some point, I had the most eerie sensation. I could feel myself being in that exact spot when the building was intact, coming into that building for a gathering, and being in the very same spot at the top of a stairway. The camp has really rebuilt since then. It's been interesting to go back and see the new buildings go up. And I certainly hope they don't have any more encounters with wildfires.
The earth, the air, the fire, the water, return, 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 return. The earth, the air, the fire, the water, return, return.
That was The Earth, the Air, the Fire, the Water by Labana. And I first learned about Labana through our friend Becky.
Oh, good.
Enjoy them very much.
Mm-hmm. That was interesting. I didn't know she'd had that past of helping with putting out
wildfires.
Yeah, well, and then the after, term escapes me right now, but
mop up,
right, yeah. And turns out, possibly not sufficient mopping up may be responsible for that Paradise Fire in California. There had been a fire at a New Year's party, and they put that out, and it happens to be the exact same location where the next fire got started. Anyway, it's important work. And
it is important work.
Yeah, interesting to hear about your feeling of being transported back to that building when it existed, when you were there cleaning it up. Yeah, very interesting. Thank you, Becky.
Thank you, Becky. And from now, we have a submission from Leslie Black, who is also a member of the radio station and a producer of programs. Thank you, Leslie, and let's listen to her submission.
Hello, it's Leslie with a story about fire. While living in Iowa in 1980, I bought and moved to a 40-acre wooded parcel near Park Rapids, Minnesota. It was soon a hobby farm after improvements of a lane, underground power lines, a well, a building site, and a 1963 Marshfield house trailer. Soon after the move, a neighbor farmer came to help me burn some brush in a plot suitable for a garden. I'd never started an outside fire for that purpose. It got out of control, and we raked and raked vigorously. I was so scared. We had my 5-year-old run up to the trailer and call the fire marshal, whose number was already on my emergency numbers list by the phone. By the time he arrived with the giant water tank in his pickup bed, it was already out. The hair on my arms and eyebrows had been singed. It was so scary. That day I learned so much respect for fire. and my lush green homestead was saved.
There's a fire, and all the lines are down. There's a panic in the town, and all the wires are crossed. Now they're calling in the dogs, and the teeth shine like pearls in a witchy underworld. And they all feed the flames when they're moving ahead. Everyone knows your name. In the dark, it's all the same.
Thank you, Leslie, and that is truly a frightening experience when a planned fire gets out of control. She submitted a follow-up to her submission that says, in the audio, I didn't really convey the panic and sweat from raking and worrying. After it was out, we both fell to the ground exhausted. Yeah, it's a truly soul-striking fear. When you think fire is going to get out of control.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, you can well imagine what she went through then. I'm really impressed that she had her five-year-old trained to go in the house and call 911 and he could tell them where to go.
Yeah.
That you were a good mother, Leslie, a good parent.
You still are a good mother, Leslie.
Yes, I'm sure.
And I, too, have had some brush burning cause great deal of panic. And from what I read, 95% of all wildfire and urban interface fires are caused by people in some regard or another. And through my conversations with my local fire department, apparently many of those close calls are from people burning their brush. Mm-hmm. So the brush needs to be burned or dealt with, but there are steps to be taken and there are ways to learn about it. One really cohesive training process is a program called FireWise. FireWise is a national program, and then there is the regional Minnesota FireWise. And I'm happy to report that my township of Duluth Township is an active and growing FireWise community.
All right.
So
good.
I'm looking forward to being involved in that.
There's a lot of FireWise activity up in the Brimson area too, partly through the Brimson Volunteer Fire Department.
There's a map that you can go to on FireWise Minnesota, and it tells you where the FireWise, the active FireWise communities are. Mm-hmm. And there's one a little bit northwest of Duluth Township. And then the closest next one is Brimson.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot to be gained from those.
Right. They will have someone come out to your specific place and evaluate all the different factors that may be contributing to your fire risk, wildfire risk, and what you could do about them.
Right.
Yeah. Get an individualized
assessment.
Assessment, exactly. Yeah.
I have an assessment scheduled for as soon as the snow melts.
Good. And speaking of brush fires and getting out of control being such a big proportion of the sources of fires. There was one just last weekend in Lakewood Town, in Duluth Township.
Oh.
A good friend of mine was expected to show up at a gathering of lots of old friends from decades ago, and she had to call in later that she wasn't able to attend because they had somebody was burning brush. When there's Duluth Township would depend on where in Duluth Township. If there's 3 inches or more of snow cover, you can burn brush and don't need to get a permit or anything. And that might have been the case, but then the wind came up so strongly.
It was very strong.
He was not expecting that and had to call the fire department, and they spent quite a bit of time putting that out because it was near a stand of trees that could have, if it went the wrong way, could have started them. And so, yeah, it's here too. You don't normally expect wildland fires in the winter.
And as it gets warmer and there's more drought year after year, the risk goes up. Mm-hmm. And even though the Minnesota DNR website says that everything is green for all of Minnesota, does not mean that everything is safe and that you can just not take those practices.
Right.
And you need to have a backup plan for every fire that you burn.
Good point.
And now, after having just heard from us, we have Fran's submission to the prompt fire.
Voices. Fire. I guess I have a love-hate relationship with fire. It is the best of elements. It is the worst of elements. First, the worst. I have been the victim of two house fires. In both cases, I was living alone in very small, older rented houses in Lakewood Township. The two fires were about a mile and 3.5 years apart, both back in the 1970s. There was no fire insurance, either for the buildings or for their contents. I lost virtually everything in the first fire and probably 3/4 of everything in the second, including an old upright piano I'd gotten for free somehow. Everything didn't amount to that much in either case. I was already leading a rather Spartan existence, but it's not relative. Everything is everything, including some old journals and photos. I still had small stashes at my mother's in Minneapolis, and people were extremely generous with hand-me-down clothing and housewares in both cases. How did they happen? The first case was probably stupidity. I was burning coal in a cast iron coal wood burner and knew nothing about chimney maintenance. My landlady, just across the road, should have known, but the place hadn't been occupied for years before my roommate and I had moved in about a year before. I guess it just wasn't on her radar, and I think I had provided the stove. That's another story. It started after dark in February and was a total loss by the time I returned home. No one was hurt. After having the experience of arriving home to find one's abode a smoldering pile of ashes, I was always a little anxious driving home to my next rural rented house until I came over the rise in the road where I could see that it was intact. The second fire was discovered mid-afternoon in September. I was trail clearing up on Hawk Ridge and saw a plume of dark smoke in the far distance. The thought crossed my mind, that could be my house burning. But I probably chuckled at my paranoia, and I remember rationalizing it as the boiler at Lakewood School firing up for the first time that school year on a chilly day. Sometime later, a friend who knew where I was and heard about the fire came to find me at Hawk Ridge and confirm my first fleeting suspicion. The fire having started late afternoon on a weekday, some of the volunteer firefighters were able to see the smoke when driving home from work and responded in good time. Part of the back room was still intact when I got there. The cause of this one was also undetermined, though the firemen found an old phosphorus miner's headlamp under the porch, to which they attributed the ignition source. The stove and chimney were not at all suspect this time. I always wondered about their theory, especially given some other factors at the time might have suggested arson. Yet another story. Since starting to write this response, I decided to contact the state fire marshal to see what any fire incident or investigation reports might say about either of those fires. I'll be lucky if I learn anything. But there is the good side of fire. In fact, I've often said the most important criterion for quality of life for me is living with a wood-burning stove. I feel like it might be something surviving in my genes from an early era of our species when it was so crucial to basic survival. Like many people, I find the play of the flames and the gradual combustion of the wood hypnotic. The smell of a wood fire is probably my favorite smell. My favorite sight in life, though, is not the fire itself, but the sight of smoke coming out of a chimney. It says warmth, home, comfort, rest. Not that providing one's own firewood is restful. The entire process of cutting my own trees, bucking, splitting, and stacking, and sometimes restacking the wood warms one many times over, as the saying goes. But the whole process is perhaps my favorite pastime. Just today I was looking online for a better ash bucket and stumbled upon a Reddit group about firewood. Someone had posted the question, I think I'm addicted to firewood, wood splitters, axes, and wood stoves. Is that a thing? I could relate to that, and even more to someone else's response. I split my first log when I was, oh, maybe 8 years old. I'm in my 50s. When I need to think, need to feel peace, I go to my pile and split wood. I live in the north, and it doesn't matter what the temps are, I split wood. Splitting wood is how I observe the seasons change. My wife knows there's a strong chance that in 20 or 30 years, I won't come in for our afternoon coffee, that she'll walk out into the woods and find me near the final, axe nearby, and my heart finally having given out. She knows I'll have been happy when it ended. Well, that sounds like a good way to go to me, too. Couldn't believe it when I found that song yesterday and talking about the piano possibly being firewood and, and it tied into both parts of my submission there. So, well, we do want to talk a little about the next prompt before we've just got about 3 minutes left here. And we didn't mention it earlier. It is hitchhiking. And that came up partly our roads episode, I believe it was. Richmond talked about a hitchhiking experience he had. And
cars.
Right, right. And we've both had our own hitchhiking experiences from decades ago. We want to be clear, we are not endorsing hitchhiking.
It.
Right. This was, what, 50 years ago when I had my experiences. And it wasn't exactly considered safe then, but it absolutely would not be recommended at these times. But there are many great hitchhiking stories out there. Plus, I was able to put my hands on a segment that was done for a class at UMD back in the mid-80s, a friend of mine produced, with three of us sharing our hitchhiking stories. And some of that I will be able to share next program as well. So that will air February 15th. Taking submissions preferably up through that Thursday, the 13th. And as Francis shared earlier, we always welcome responses to previous episodes. If this has inspired you to think about stories of fire or relationships to fire in your life, certainly the next program won't be too late to share that. And how you do that, the email again is ktwhwriters@gmail.com. So, anything else you wanted to share? I think we'll launch one more song here to make the transition back to our the rest of our day's programming here.
There's so many fire songs that I've just got a whole list there of
right.
through the ages.
Leo played a beautiful one on his Fire Music show the other day, and we will, I think, go out with as much of that as we can play, which is only about a minute here. But this will be Charlie Parr and Pale Fire. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Fran.
Yep. Thank you, Francis. See you all in a couple of weeks.
Sunset for the longest while at the edge of my sight. I seen the sunset for the longest while at the edge of my sight.